If you wanted to do something that you didn't know how to do, perhaps something that you weren't even sure if it was possible, what might be your best step forward? One answer might be to find someone else that's already done it. So, after I recovered my health from ME/CFS, fibromyalgia and POTS, one of the first positive advocacy efforts was to find others that had also recovered and interview them and share their stories. That was back in 2013, and since then I've spoken to hundreds of people that have recovered, both fully and partially. My focus then and still now is to publish different stories of recovery. And what do they have in common? Are there secrets to recovery? If so, what are they? I wanted to share my learnings from all these years with you through a conversation. One other person that has more recently started to do the same thing and do these kind of interviews is Raylan Agle with her wonderful YouTube channel. So I thought she was the ideal person to have that conversation about what we have learned from speaking with others that have recovered like us. We unpack our learnings and address some of our concerns in this episode of Wisdom from the Other Side. I hope you gain great insights for your recovery journey, and hopefully you'll share your story with me one day soon. Just a short but important message regarding the content of this podcast. The ideas, concepts, and opinions expressed in this recording, website, and associated media and products are intended to be used for educational and information purposes only. Nothing presented is intended to replace your physician, nor are they a substitute for medical diagnosis, advice, or treatment. This podcast is provided with the understanding that the authors, guests, speakers, and publishers are not rendering medical advice of any kind. So, thanks for coming to join me on our chat today, Raylan.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Dan. I'm really excited to do this. I'm honored to be here. I think this is a great idea.
Yeah, well, you know, I was really motivated to do these interviews in the beginning because I never met anyone who had the illness during all my years until the end, right? Where they seemed to be popping up everywhere when I drafted CFS Unraveled. And so I wanted to, I always felt hopeless. Like there's no chance of recovery. I never even heard of it. In fact, that's a theme I still hear from people. Mm-hmm. People who've been in sick for decades and who've done advocacy work and all this kind of thing. And they've never even heard of the term recovery, you know? Recovery is normally something like someone says they recovered, but they didn't really, or they weren't really ill, or some sort of a snake oil pitch or something like this.
Yeah.
And many people don't realize that this is really a thing that happens. Was it similar for you?
Oh my goodness, yes. And, you know, before we even dive into all this, I just really want to thank you for all that you've done and all the information that you've put out. It is incredible that you've been putting out recovery interviews by 2013, or since 2013. I became unwell with this in 2008, and I searched and searched, and I couldn't come across anyone who had recovered. I couldn't find any information about recovery. And I think I spent a few years really digging and researching, but by 2013, I had given up on the world. Just everything out there was, in terms of information, was very discouraging, I found, and hopeless. So I didn't even have the benefit of the recovery interviews that you're putting out. But yeah, and every single person, I believe, that I've talked to or that I've interviewed for my channel that has fully recovered has said something really similar. That, like, I didn't know of anyone who had recovered. I'm the only person I know of that hadn't recovered. So, yeah, it's really unfortunate that this is the case.
Yeah, and it's been really interesting because this is really deepened. I mean, this is your experience, this is my experience, this is people we interview, but there's also the flip side. And the flip side is that actually there's people who recover everywhere. So at first it was like, oh, I'd find someone on the internet and I'd interview them. But then after a while, I actually find these people are like literally across the road from me, you know, like I'd bump into neighbors and I could almost tell, well, I could tell that this person was focused on health and well-being. And, you know, there's certain things, characteristics, when you speak to a lot of people who've recovered, you go, you know, I think this person may have recovered. And I actually asked them outright, and this poor lady, she almost jumped out of her skin. She's like, what? You know, how do you know? What makes you ask me, right?
Wow.
And I thought that was quite funny. And you know, I remember just in my children's school, the parents, you know, you have a community when you tend to have children at school. And I mean, just from the people we know. So obviously I don't speak to every parent, right? But when they're little, you speak to them quite a bit. Just in my daughter's year, and there's about 100 kids at school. I mean, I met 3 parents who had recovered.
Wow.
So I'm not saying that's a scientifically, statistically valid thing or anything, but I mean, it just shows it's not rare. And I wondered, is it just me who has this experience? And then I found when people are on my program and they recover, or they're in their doing their recovery phase, they often also have a similar experience where they'll tell me, oh yeah, well, I've never met anyone who recovered, but yeah, actually I've met to the yoga teacher's recovered, or my naturopath has recovered, or my doctor's recovered. Or, I mean, one lady told me, and I'm like, how does this happen? She said, I went on holiday for the first time in like, you know, 20 years. And we went there and we went to the hotel, and I'm talking to the hotel clerk. And it turns out that the hotel clerk, you know, the reception had recovered. And all I'm thinking is, how does that come up?
Wow.
Do you know, I mean, hi, I'm here. Here's the key for numbers 8. By the way, I'm recovered for 5. I'm like, how does this happen? Do you know what I mean? So I think this is actually a lot more common. And the thing we've got to recognize is that a lot of people with CFS and fibro never even get diagnosed. And a lot of people, when they recover, I mean, the doctor never even knows about it, because the people just stop coming, right? It's not like he goes, oh, yes, let me put that on the register. I've got another recovered person, right? So, yeah, I think it's actually a lot more common than perhaps any of us realize.
I think so, too. And there's this stat floating around, I'm sure you've heard it, that a lot of people are told, or they find on the internet, that 95% of people who get ME/CFS never recover. And I think, where is this coming from? And who is keeping track? And virtually everyone I talked to who has recovered, myself included, did so outside of mainstream medicine. So there's no really way to track this. And most people aren't reporting it. Most people don't start YouTube channels. You know, most people don't even share their story on other channels. So it's great to hear that you're finding it's such a common thing. And I think it is far more common than we realize. And I think that hopelessness that people get with this diagnosis is really dangerous. And yeah, it's...
Honestly, I don't believe there's any scientific validity to these kind of statistics, right? I honestly, with all my heart, I just don't believe it. I mean, like I said, who tracks these people? None of the people that I've spoken to, nobody gets tracked. Like, this doesn't get registered anywhere. And if you're going to do a survey and you do it in a chronic illness community, like a CFS or fibro community, well, these are people who've been ill a long time, who are not getting better, and you ask them, did anyone get better? And of course, everyone's going to say no. Like, how many people stick around in those communities once they get well? Yeah. And even the ones who want to, like, I do come across this quite more often than you think, where people recover and then they want to stick around and they want to share. Nobody wants to know. Nobody wants to know. In fact, I did an interview last night with a lady, and she said she went to 2 meetings. She was in a support group for years, and she went to 2 meetings after she had recovered because nobody wanted to talk to her anymore. It was just like nobody wanted to hear her story. They said, oh, well, yeah, maybe you're feeling better for now, but how long is that going to last, you know? And that was 10 years previous, by the way. She's still well. So, yeah. I think many people have that experience.
Yeah, I'm laughing a little bit, not because it's funny. It's because it resonates and it reminds me of something that I've been going through. I don't know if I imagine you've had something similar, but when I started sharing my story that I recovered, it was other people that had recovered started reaching out to me, just really excited to have found me, because all of a sudden we felt really alone. It was a strange thing. Like, we almost needed our own little weird support group because we didn't seem to fit anywhere else anymore. And we kind of thought we were these weird anomalies that we were the only ones that were in this place. It was just this really exciting thing. I get these DMs on Instagram and different places like, hey, I recovered too. This is amazing. I'm so happy to have found you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, this is, I did a podcast recording the other day, and I had a moment where I suddenly got very emotional. And it was quite surprising because, you know, you think you've been recovered for a long time. You've kind of, it's behind you. But we were talking about this thing of sharing a burden and being understood, because nobody knows what you're going through. You feel so alone. You think you're the only one who's ill with this illness. And I talked about when I read a story on the internet about someone who had, like, you know, it was like me. It was all the same symptoms and experiences. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not alone. But just like you say, that's one thing. This is why many people get drawn into the groups. But it's the same on the other side. And I have to say, it was quite an experience and a privilege meeting so many people that have recovered now. I mean, I've met hundreds of people who've recovered. And yeah, it's like you're a kindred spirit. You've walked through hell together. It's like you're like war veterans. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we have these deep learnings. One of the things that I found when I interview people is they would often say this. They would say, I'm glad I had this illness because it's changed how I engage in life. And if I hadn't done this, my life wouldn't be the same as it is now. I would still be living like I did beforehand. And I used to always like shrink away in my chair going, is there a mute button? I have to edit this interview. I can't publish this. You know, because it's like, how could you say such a horrid thing, you know? Like, glad you had this illness. I'm like, I was never glad I had the illness, you know? But I hear it all the time. And so it's interesting to have these common themes.
Yeah, and it's, I hear that too, not from everybody, but from a lot of people. And I've said it myself, and it's even still hard for me to say, like, it's like, ugh, you know, I have a physical reaction, like, because it was such a nightmare. It was such hell, but I do have gratitude for it. And I cannot imagine where I would be right now without it. So if I could go back and take it away, it's still hard to say, but I don't know that I would, because it changed me dramatically and into, you know, got me onto the track of the life that I wanted to be living. It changed who I was, you know, fundamentally as a person. It was such a massive growth boot camp opportunity for me that I think, well, if I take it away, then where would I be? And I do hear that from quite a few people.
And what an interesting reflection. I mean, I probably shrunk away because I probably didn't feel like that. For me, it was just a horrible negative thing to go through. And, my recovery probably didn't involve as much of a spiritual journey. It was more like, oh, I've cracked the science behind it. You know, that was sort of my experience. And, so I never talked about the spiritual aspect, if you like, of recovery, because that wasn't my experience. However, and the longer I do this, the more I've realized how important this is, because I see this as a common theme, and perhaps not so much just in terms of being able to recover, but as in staying recovered. It becomes really important for that, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay. So, and perhaps some of those differences, right, between those two experiences that we just talked about, I think has to do with the lead up of the illness. I mean, what has been your experience about the lead up to people's illnesses? Have you seen common themes?
I have, for sure. And of course, you know, I'm not at all saying that this is everybody's situation, and it's purely anecdotal. And I've interviewed a few dozen people, and from those people that I've spoken to, there are definitely themes leading up. And the biggest one that I've noticed is that it was some combination of people who were pushing themselves to the limits, either physically, mentally, or both. You know, they're extreme athletes, they're working two jobs, they're a single parent who's going to school, they're a perfectionist, they're whatever. They've got no time for rest in their life, and they just go, 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 go. And then some sort of stress happens on their body or their mind. They have some kind of physical or mental trauma, and whether it be a car accident or a virus or a death of a loved one, and they just seem to crash and they don't recover. Do you find something similar in the people that you talk to?
Absolutely. And this is integral to the whole explanation I give of ANS dysfunction being central, right? Because in the beginning, I think this is the difficulty that modern medicine had, because they're like, well, how can you have this person here gets a virus and gets this illness, and this person has PTSD, this person was in a car accident, and, you know, this person had a surgery or childbirth, and this one got divorced. They're completely different things. Some are mental, some are physical. Well, they're all the same. They're all stressors on the autonomic nervous system. And I think a lot of people talk about this whole story about a virus, because so many of us, and I admit I was probably one of those, would say, oh, it was a virus, you know, when I got ill. Because that's exactly how I felt. When I got ill, it felt like I got a flu, and it kind of didn't go away for like 7 years. And I did actually have a vaccination immediately beforehand, but I never even considered the possibility that that had anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that was the sole cause or anything like that. There were a whole bunch of other factors. But it felt like a virus. And so I talked sometimes about this whole idea of the virus theory, because does a virus make you sick? Well, I think maybe 5 years ago, or even, let's say, be honest, let's say even 2 years ago, people would have said, well, what a stupid thing to ask. Of course, a virus makes you sick. We all know that. But it's been my view for a long time. That's only one component of illness. And I've always believed that many people have viruses and don't get sick. Now, we never tested for this. No one ever said, oh, I feel fantastic. Doctor, can you check if I've got the cold or flu virus? Can we do some blood tests? That never happened, right? But of course, since the pandemic, we now test people by the millions, and we find all these people who've had the virus and spread the virus, this is how often we find them, who didn't even have a sniffle. And then on the other hand, we see people who are like, literally dying. So that's interesting. And it's always made me wonder, how much is it actually from a viral infection? And how much is it simply an immune system reaction? Or is it that we're vulnerable to a virus and we get sick from the virus? But it's not necessarily that it was a nasty virus. Do you hear that a lot about the people getting a virus?
It's the most common thing that I hear. There are other things as well, for sure, but it's the most common one that I hear. And that was my experience as well. And my mother faced this illness as well, and hers also started with a virus. I think about even just my own case, though. I had had many, many viruses before this one, and it just felt like a flu that I got. So why didn't I recover this time? Typically I could just rest in a few days and I'd be better. And this one, I rested for months, and the more I rested, the worse I got. So
that's all right. And that's the whole thing. Why would you suddenly have had all these viruses? Did you work in a virus clinic? It's like you probably didn't have any more viruses than you did beforehand. It's just you got sick from the viruses, right? And that's sort of the lead up. And I see this with most people, that they have hints. Not all people. I have come across people where literally they're fine every day, and literally overnight they become horribly ill. I've spoken to people who've woken up the next day and they've gone from perfectly healthy to I can't get out of bed, and they're like dying, right, overnight. And I've even spoken to people where it happened not overnight, but during the day. So they are like, I'm all good, I'm healthy, everything's fine. Do you want a cup of tea? Okay, what time do we have to go out? Ooh, I feel sick. Bang, like that. And that's really kind of bizarre when you hear that, because you're like, that's creepy. I'm actually getting goosebumps.
Yeah, it is crazy. And most people I talk to haven't said that, but some have, and it shocks me. I say, when did this all start for you? And they'll say, April 23rd at 4 p.m. in 2013 or something like so specific. I'm like, how is that? How?
And I remember the date and the time so precisely. Yeah.
Like, that is not the answer I was expecting.
Absolutely. And this has happened to me many times. I've heard people, it's not common. I wouldn't say like what percentage, but it is a small minority where people have this moment. But when it happens during the day, it's very odd. It's very bizarre. Mm-hmm. So we see these are the common themes to how people get ill. And I think it's interesting to note these because this is what has helped people come to more comfort and confidence in the explanation of why this illness is happening. Because when we don't know what's going on, I think it makes the whole experience more frightening and the whole possibility of recovery feels more unlikely. Because if you don't know why you're ill, then how can you possibly recover, right? And certainly that's how it felt for me during those 5 years, because I went to every doctor, we tested everything. To be honest, the only thing I had in my mind is it's some unknown virus, because they couldn't find anything when they tested me. Except Epstein-Barr, you know, apparently. Mm-hmm. But so that's what I thought. But I think from here, it's really about saying, well, okay, well, what then changes? Because let's think about it. You were sick. Now, I haven't done an interview with you as yet, and perhaps that's something we need to look at. But how long were you ill for?
About 10 years.
So for 10 years, you're ill, and then you start to recover. Hmm. So now are we saying, the question we got to ask ourselves, is there something special about people who recover? Are people who recover the lucky people? Yeah, well, you know, these are the kind of thoughts or themes people might have. And if you think about it, well, you were both. You were a person who didn't recover. Mm-hmm. And then you were a person who did recover. Now, it's the same person, right? So what changed? Well, what happened? What happened at the moment things started to turn around? And is it a theme you see with other people?
Yes, it is a theme that I have seen. I mean, for me, I went through something that I've heard from quite a few other people. When I first became unwell, I was very determined to get well, and I spent about 2 years just frantically trying to heal myself. I spent every penny I had, plus a bunch of money that I didn't have. I tried, you know, I did tons of testings, everything. I tried everything. Like, really, I could give you a really long laundry list of things that I tried. And it helped me out a little bit, but it didn't get me very far. And then I reached a point where I just was sort of in recovery efforts burnout. And I couldn't do anymore. I didn't even know what else to try. I felt like I tried everything. So I just coasted for a while, for quite a long time. And then I realized that I couldn't live my whole life that way, because it was just, every single day was still a struggle. I was better, I was functional, I could do things, but every single day was a battle for me to get through. So for me, and what I hear from other people, when I finally did recover, it was getting hyper-focused, and also with the right tools and the right support and the right information. Because the first time I was just lost and desperate and completely stressed out and depressed. So I was not in a good state to be making any kind of recovery. So when I finally did recover, I put virtually everything in my life on hold, put all my focus onto my recovery, you know, worked on my mental health, worked on my stress, and, you know, experimented. It wasn't like I had a perfect plan from day one, but I had an idea. I'd seen things over the years that had helped me. So I quit my job and I just put everything I had into getting better. And it took longer. I was hoping it would take about a year of focused effort and I'd get past it. It ended up taking closer to two. But yeah, I think it was just creating that calm, lower stress, healing environment with support and prioritizing almost 100% getting past this.
So these are really powerful themes that I hear over and over and over in every recovery interview, right? But I want to, before we go into those, and we will break some of these down and probably add a whole bunch more. I guess what I'm so curious about, and this is, if you've seen this, is immediately beforehand, right? Hmm. So if I say, when did your recovery start? And you put a date on it and go, okay, how did you feel in the 6 months before that? And here's my experience. And see if your experience with other people or yourself is the same. My experience is, it's usually a low point. I have found that the vast majority, I would say, of people get to a point where they just go, it's just so bad, they can't cope with it. Or it's so bad that they go, I can't live with this. And some people even have very dark themes around this time. Or they get bedbound, or they have, you know, the children go up to a certain age where they leave the house and as parents, they never go with them. Something happens where they suddenly go, it has to change. And so the thing of, so it's another run-up. See, in the beginning, nobody wants to settle for being ill. We all go and try everything and do all of that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't lead to anything because nobody's got any answers, right? No one's got that magic pill. And so eventually we give up. Not all of us. Not all of us, obviously. But certainly that was my experience. We give up. And then something precipitates this. It must change. For some people, it's a diagnosis. Right? I find that actually quite common too. Very common. Where people are ill for 10 years, then they get diagnosed, told it's an incurable illness, and they're like, okay, now I'm going to do something. Yeah, have you had similar experiences?
I have. I mean, I experienced that myself, and I definitely have heard that from a number of other people. And it doesn't always look that way on the outside. You know, with my own experience, it wasn't the lowest point health-wise when I finally turned things around. I had been worse in the past, but it had been going on for so many years and I was barely functioning and I just couldn't see a future like this. So it was very much a low point for me. Like, this has to change. Like, this stops now, even though it wasn't the worst that my health had ever been. And I've definitely heard that from quite a few other people that you're right. They are in a, it's interesting that you can get so motivated from such a low place, but that frustration can be a powerful motivator.
Yeah, and it's about, I mean, here, as we go into the themes now of what we see in people that recover and what differentiates them from the people who haven't recovered or us when we didn't recover, right? Because I think the people who recover are not different than everyone else, right? What there really is just this feeling of this. There's enough pain to sustain your efforts. What we all fall into is a comfort, okay? Because you just want to get on with your life. Like, here's the funny thing: you would think that this hunger for life is a good thing. I want to live. I want to see. The majority of people, I can't say the majority of people, but so many of us are not actually depressed, right? Depressed. When people are truly depressed, they don't want to engage in life. What I find, many people feel depressed and they're very low with CFS, but they are just busting to get out there and go to a party, go do some sports. They want to live their life, yeah? And they can't. And what happens is that hunger can seem to stop people because as soon as they feel a bit better, I've got to get job, I'm going to do a project, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And their recovery gets deprioritized because they're finally going, oh, finally I can live a little.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen when people really go for the full recovery. They kind of say, oh, I feel good, I could do things, but you know what? All I care about is getting fully well. And they suspend their hunger for living a little bit, or they temper it, and they just say, this is what it's all about. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's your experience too?
I think that's a really good point about depression. And I think that's the confusing thing, both with people who are facing this illness and also for the doctors who are trying to treat us. Because yes, I think we are depressed, but it's not classic or clinical depression, at least in my opinion, from what I've experienced and what I've seen, and that it's not our core issue. It wasn't what precipitated everything. We experience depression because of the hell that we're going through and the frustration that we're going through. But as soon as our health perks up a little bit, that depression disappears, you know, and it only comes back when we feel like our life is being taken away from us again. And I'm thinking back even to my mother, who caught this a lot from doctors, that she was just depressed. And she knew that that was not her core problem. She just wanted her life back. And I started seeing a counselor, ended up taking her own life after decades with this illness. She just, it was just feeling so hopeless for her. And not too long before that happened, I was seeing a counselor. And when I explained the situation of my mother, he said, she's not depressed. Everything I explained, he's like, she's not depressed. Like she was faking it somehow or something. She's like, she puts makeup on. She, you know, she does different things. She showers. She takes care of her appearance. Like something, like I think it is very confusing, the whole issue with depression and what that means and what that looks like and how it's expressed. Because I think it is dangerous in ME/CFS because we do experience it. And a lot of people do get to a lot of really low points. But, you know, where that depression is coming from, I think, is more important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, we're talking about this mental aspects of recovery. And some people might be listening going, well, why are we talking about mental stuff? I mean, this is a real physical illness, right? But your mental fortitude, your mental attitude, your strength is everything when you recover from anything. Like if you have a stroke, your mental attitude is the most important thing. Your mental health is the most important thing, right? I mean, you don't think you're going to turn up to rehab and go through all that hard work and suffering if you're not up to it mentally, right? Okay. Recovery from any chronic illness or recovery from any challenge, it's all about your mind. Because your mind determines the actions that you take. And I think, you know, people forget about the importance of morale during recovery. And when you look at, this is another theme I found with people who recover, is that they turn around and they focus on this self-care and morale. And I often tell the story about Bear Grylls. Do you know who Bear Grylls is?
Yes.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, he's supposed to be, you know, surviving in a jungle. He's eating slugs out of trees. He's a butch, tough man, right? And he walks past this some tree and he grabs a leaf and he goes, oh, this leaf is the blah, blah, blah leaf. He starts rubbing it in his hands and he goes, when you rub it, oils come out and, oh, it smells lovely. It's like you're going to like a spa, you know, and having a, and you can rub it on your face and, oh, your skin feels so soft. And it's like, what happened here? Like, what's going on? And he looks into the camera and he says, one of the most important things in a survival situation is to look after your morale. Because if your morale is low, your ability to see opportunities and to be objective and intelligent in decision making is diminished. So anything you can do to boost your morale in a survival situation is absolutely essential, right? And I remember just going, boom, absolutely. That's what happens in chronic illness, yeah? And he's even said, like, you know, you often see me eating food, and he says, the amount of energy I get from this food is minimal. It probably has zero impact on my survival. But what it does do is this mere act of having something to eat boosts your morale, and the impact of that is greater than the nutrition that you get.
I think that is so important, and it took me a long time to appreciate this, and that's what I credit the failure to a lot of my earlier recovery efforts, is that I didn't get this piece of it. But I really get it now, and I talk about this a lot in my videos. I actually just today finished recording a video all about this topic. You know, I talked about it in my book. I think that your mental health needs to be the core, the foundation, the backbone of your whole recovery program, because I think it's the glue that holds everything together. I mean, for one, we know that when we're in a stressed out, depressed state, our body's not in a state where it's, you know, those healing mechanisms are engaged. But also, you know, this is your control center. This is what has to get you up every day to keep doing the work, to keep doing the reps, and to keep getting yourself, you know, past this. So without that in place, nothing else really matters. And I don't think you're going to make a lot of progress. And I think it's really understandable that when people become physically unwell, that we put all our focus on our physical symptoms. And I think society, you know, and the medical community have all brought us up believing that that's what we're supposed to do. And it feels like a waste of time or a privilege or something that you can do if you have the energy to take care of your mental health. But I think that's where we need to start. And, you know, I say this in my videos. I said this in my book. If I could go back the very first thing I do that I would tell myself would be, as soon as I got that diagnosis, as soon as I realized what I was facing, is the first person I would have called was a psychologist, a therapist of some kind, so that I could get some support, because it's so tough and it's such a marathon. And it's one of the most alarming things that I hear from people, the depths of depression that they get into, understandably, when they are not making progress and they can't get past this. And it's just, how are you going to get past this when you're dealing with that kind of depression? How are you in the mental state that you need to be in to do what you need to do? Because this is not easy. It's not, for most people I talk to, it's, they can get past this, but it's not an easy thing for most of us.
And that probably leads us to what are the things that stop people. Maybe before we talk about what are the key things we've learned from people that allow them to recover, but perhaps that is probably the number one thing that allows people to recover, is that they don't do the things that stop us from recovering. Okay. And I think that really is true, is people don't get caught up in the pitfalls of recovery. I mean, to be honest, Raylan, if you had said that to me during my years of illness, I probably would have scoffed at you. Oh yeah, mental health, blah, 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 blah. My mental health is fine. I just need to be able to not feel rubbish every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have recognized the truth behind this as a 30 to 35 year old guy, right? But now, yeah, this is absolutely true. I 100% agree with you. This is our foundation, our mental well-being, our mental resilience, our self-care, our self-love is central. And if I want to just highlight how essential this is, at least once a month, I'll have this conversation where people are telling me about, they don't know what to do, they're feeling this, they're feeling upset, they're feeling ill, they're having appointments with a doctor, that, you know the drama of the illness, right? Everything is kind of falling apart. And say to me, well, what should I do? This is from some people in my program, right? And I said, what should I do? And I look at them and I say, well, what you should do is you should get well. You should do the things you need to in order to get well so that you don't have these problems. Now, this sounds so stupid. What a crazy thing to say. But but it's literally laid out before them. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. I'm not saying it's the magic cure, but there's a process here, right? But they're not doing the things that they need to recover, because they're so caught up in this tailspin mentally and emotionally of dealing with the illness, that even with the steps directly in front of them, they don't take them.
Yeah, I think it's because also a lot of us have been socialized to believe that, or to think about recovery as something that is done to them. You know, something that's going to happen, a surgery, a pill, a therapy, and then it's going to go away. Where, at least in my experience and the people I talk to with things like ME/CFS, it's something that you have to do. And it's not an exciting or, you know, sexy or glamorous process. I think of it a lot like going to the gym. You know, people who, let's say, you know, a healthy person, all of a sudden, like, I want to be big and buff and lots of muscles. And, you know, what do I have to do to get there? Well, you're just going to have to get up every single day and pick up those weights and keep doing the reps day after day after day as the months pass. And on any given day, it's not going to seem like you're really getting anywhere. But as the months pass, you'll see the trajectory that you're on, and you're going to get towards where you're trying to go. And I think with chronic illness recovery, it's the same thing. It's every day, just a whole bunch of small things, and just getting up and just doing the reps day after day after day after day. And it's hard to see the progress in the moment, but it is getting you there once you find that formula that works for you.
Absolutely, and sometimes we have to adjust that formula, you know, as we plateau or get frustrated. Yeah, what you say is so true, and it's a cure. Cure is a myth. Can you think of any diseases? Just tell me 10 diseases off the top of your head. Any diseases?
Oh, just any diseases?
Off. Don't think about them. Just tell me any diseases you know.
Heart disease, hypertension, cancer, arthritis. Do I have to do 10?
Okay. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, reflux.
There we go.
Now, let's look. You think about any illnesses, right? And you go, cure. Okay. How many of these illnesses do people go to a doctor and say, cure me? And they The doctor says, well, you've got this. Sorry, no problem. Here's the cure. Now you're cured.
Yeah, I can't think of any. I don't know why we have this idea, like it's some sort of instantaneous process that's done to us, but all of these things involve a lot.
Well, of most of them, they have some treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them start to, they talk about a cure, like with cancer, some people say they get cured, you know. But the cure is defined as what? 12-month survival, 5-year survival, right? Yeah. 5 years, 1 day, you get cancer again, and then you pass away. You were cured, right? So these are like, it's a weird word. I mean, some things can get cured. Maybe like, I think someone during World War I had the biggest war technology breakthrough, and it was called penicillin, right? And what it does is it cures an infection.
Right.
I can't think of any other cures outside of that, right? And some people might even argue that one against me, right? So this idea of cure is a myth in our society. And most people don't know, because when we're lucky enough to be healthy, we think we can get cured for stuff. And one of the things I always hear from people is when I do recovery interviews, is they talk about this moment where they suddenly realized, nobody's got the answer for me. Nobody's going to fix me. It's up to me to work this out or to do something, right? Literally those words. Have you heard those words in interviews?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a pretty scary thing when you realize that fixing yourself is kind of a lot on you. You know, like, I hear people saying a lot of things like, I felt like I had the equivalent of, you know, going and getting some sort of medical degree, you know, how much I had to learn and how much I had to figure out how to, you know, do for myself.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, people with ME/CFS and fibromyalgia, POTS, scary patients for doctors.
Yes.
They can't come in and start spouting about, you know, like biomolecular processes that they're... Doctor goes, I heard something about this in second year lecture, and I haven't dealt with it since, you know, in medical school. So, yeah.
They're some of the most well-informed people I've ever met in my life, because they have to be. It's, you know, it's forced upon them. You become an expert on this stuff in a hurry.
Absolutely. And that probably leads us to the next pitfall, right? So the first pitfall is this getting overwhelmed, this whole mental attitude. Feeling low, feeling unresourced and not non-resilient, right? The next one is looking for people to cure you, looking for this magic cure, as opposed to recognizing it's a process and it's something you need to do with the help of your doctors, etc. So the next pitfall is, with all this expertise and becoming so well-versed and having all this knowledge, people go down all these rabbit holes. Mm. And these rabbit holes are still along the lines of, I will get cured. As in, let me find the thing that is wrong. And when I fix this thing, then I'm going to be cured. So they go and they say, oh, it's a candida infection. And I'm going to fix this. It's parasites. It's dysbiosis. It's methylation. It's my thyroid. It's, you know, there's hundreds of these things. And they go, this is the thing. And they go down and they get an expert doctor, an expert naturopath. They do it themselves, whatever it is. I think this is the thing that's going to get me well. And they get so bogged down. It's mast cell. It's chronic Lyme. It's mold toxins. It's, you know, and they get so obsessed with it. And they try and fix it. And, of course, it doesn't work. And it stops them not only from engaging in an overall recovery process, because it tends to be multilateral, and that's the other thing we'll talk about in a moment, but also it causes so much mental anguish and stress. Now, I'm curious, I mean, you do interviews with people that have recovered. I don't know how much you deal with people who are trying to recover, but is this something that you've come across a lot yourself too?
Yeah, my interviews are split up about half and half. So about half I do are people who are fully recovered, and the other half are still somewhere on their journey. Because I think people have told me that they really appreciate hearing from people who are still in it. And maybe that's why people who are recovered are getting kicked out of the support groups. But there's just something about, there's some sort of credibility and believability, I guess, for the people who are still in it. And plus, I know, as you and I have talked about before, you know, people who are at different places on their journey have a lot to offer, even if they're not fully there yet. They've learned a ton because they have to, and they have a lot of insight. So yes, it does seem to be something where people get sort of stuck, if you will. And I did as well, when it's either chasing symptoms or really focusing on those 97 different diagnoses that they receive. And no one who I've talked to who has recovered has said, oh, I did so by like addressing each one of these things individually with these specific supplements and these specific whatever treatments. It's always been a more, you know, holistic approach. And I think sometimes, because I know for me, when I first got my diagnosis, it was chronic fatigue syndrome. And I hated that diagnosis. I loathed it because I watched my mother live with it and I knew it was hell and it, to me, was hopeless. But then I was seeing an integrative medicine doctor and we did, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of tests. And the more tests we did, the more diagnoses we had. And something about that was reassuring to me and validating. And it made sense. Like, it explained why I was feeling so bad. And it felt like, okay, now I know how to tackle it. Because if my hormones are imbalanced and I have chronic Lyme disease and I have viral infections and I have adrenal fatigue and I have, you know, food sensitivities, like, I can fix each one of these things individually. But then it just, I think you just get even more bogged down and it's exhausting. And it at least for me, it never really got me anywhere. And I definitely do hear that from people that I interview as well, that this, whether it be putting a ton of focus on these individual diagnoses or putting a ton of focus on your symptoms and trying to, you know, cure yourself, for lack of a better word, by fixing each one of these symptoms, both of them don't seem to get people very far, and they tend to burn people out in their recovery until they get to the point where they just kind of throw their hands up and be like, I got nothing left. I can't do this anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, and even when you hear people say, oh, I did X, Y, Z treatment.
Yeah.
To cure, I don't know, whatever, mast cell activation syndrome or Lyme or this or that. And I hear that very rarely, by the way. But even if you hear people say that, it's not really what happened. And, you know, I've got actually a bunch of stories which I've sat on for some time that I haven't published, because there were people recovered in a something you could not scientifically validate. Things like faith or things like physical treatments that are considered either as alternate or they are, they say, even pseudoscience. And some of them I would even go so far to say are probably harmful, like extreme diets. But some people have this where they think, oh, it was because of this and it was something that is not dangerous or harmful. Or even makes some sense scientifically why it could help. But when you actually ask the questions, and this is, if you listen to my interviews, you'll always hear me digging like I don't know, like some sort of reporter trying to interview a politician. You know, I'm like digging because I'm trying to represent people who are ill, who want to know stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So I dig. And you'll find, like, they'll say, I did this magic 3-day treatment or something like this. The guy's not right, okay, and then, but did you do anything else? No, that it was because of that I recovered. Okay, great. So, did you eat the same as always? Well, you know, blah, 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 blah. Did you actually take any supplements? Well, I took these supplements. When did you start taking them? Well, around the time I was recovering. Okay, did you, blah, 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 did you change your sleep patterns? And you find out they did all this other stuff, even though they attributed to a single thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you hear on the internet how somebody recovered because they did X, Y, and Z and they found a cure, and you tried and it doesn't work, that's the reason. Because there isn't this one single magic cure. The way to recover is this multilateral thing. And you hear that from all the people who say they did a multilateral approach in a recovery, as well as the people who say they didn't do a multilateral.
Right.
They still did a multilateral one. I would say that is the case in, I would say, probably about 98% of stories. I have occasionally come across some people who do strictly a mind-body approach,
mm-hmm.
but with literally not even a change to diet, change to nothing, and who just did that and recovered solely from that. But it's usually there's other things in my experience.
That's been my experience as well. And the people that I've talked to as well, the vast majority, even if they tell you one core thing that they attribute it to, they definitely share other things that they are doing in conjunction with it. So yeah, I do think that is the key.
Is there any other sort of common themes that you hear in people's recovery?
Well, yes. I mean, one of them, a big one, I guess this goes back to our talk about mental health or our discussion about that, but it's just an attitude and a perspective on healing. It's a stubbornness sort of that people have, like this absolute determination and this relentless pursuit of getting well. And I'm not saying that every moment of every day they're in this mindset. They still have down times, they still get depressed, they have moments where they lose hope, but they don't stay there and they pull themselves back up, because I think this can be a really tough thing to get through. So everyone that I've talked to who has recovered has said something along these lines, like, I refused to accept that not recovering was an option. Like, I was going to get there. So that's definitely one theme. And it doesn't sound like an important thing. I know we want to hear like, oh, it was taking this specific supplement or something. But I think that mindset is really, really important.
Absolutely. It's my experience too.
Something else that I hear a lot as well is it's a level of acceptance with where you are with your illness. Not acceptance that you'll never get past it, but acceptance of where you are. Because to make progress, you have to break out of that boom-bust cycle that a lot of us get stuck in, understandably, because we start to feel a little bit better, so that we want to do things, and we overexert ourselves mentally or physically or both, and then we crash. And this cycle, the people that I talked to in my own experience was this as well, is that they had to get past that way of thinking and that way of living in order to recover, because you're never really making any progress. It's sort of one step forward and either one or three or seven steps back. So learning skills around pacing yourself, accepting where you are with your illness, and accepting your limitations as you work through it has been another big one. I don't know if that something you've heard as well?
Absolutely that is the case. And this is kind of reflecting what I was saying earlier. Remember I was talking about the hunger for life?
Yeah. Right?
Where people are able to suspend that hunger. All right. And the way they do that is by accepting that they're ill, they're accepting that they have a limited ability to engage in life for now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something we struggle with, because when we come to the conclusion that we're never going to get well again, doing this would be stupid. Acceptance. Oh, I'm going to accept it. I'm going to pace myself. Why am I going to pace myself? This is as good as it gets. I'm never going to get well, so
yeah.
If I don't go to this barbecue, I'm never going to go to it.
Yeah. You
know, I'll pay for it. It's not going to be ideal, but what's the difference? Yeah.
Yeah, but it's if that we can shift, think, really. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. On. Yeah, but if we can think it's temporary, our ability to accept is easier, because we just go, well, I accept it for now because I know I'll get my life back later. But most of us don't think that way.
Yeah, it's, yes, I think that's well said. I think it's, yes. And looking at long-term goals, it's a shift in thinking of short-term game towards long-term game, which is always hard for us humans. You know, we like our quick rewards, but you have to make some small sacrifices or some big sacrifices, you know, to get to that place you're trying to get to.
And I would go a little further. The point you make is so valid about acceptance. Inside the ANS Rewire program, obviously we have a whole range of strategies to talk about, but a key theme is brain training. Mm-hmm. And I get people who go into my program, and I call them the miracle cure people, right? And they go in, they're like housebound, they're like terribly ill for like decades, like multiple decades. And they go in my program, and then 90 days later, they're at the age of 70-something or in their 60s, they're hiking in the mountains every day and getting IT band injuries from over-exercise, right? And you kind of go, that sounds too good to be true. And I'm of the old school thinking, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, right? So I've actually done in-depth interviews with these miracle cure people, because this is not everyone's experience in the program, or in recovery in general, right? And sometimes it's even 6 weeks. Like, it's, you know, it can be very short, even a matter of weeks. And we look at it and say, why? And what you find is that typically these people were able to engage in all the processes because some of them they've already adopted, right? But they're also able to engage in the brain training, like, perfectly. Like, and most people have to learn how to do this brain training techniques, and there's complications. And some of the complications are psychological complications. So they're not just physical complications, why you have difficulty with brain training. And these psychological complications are basically this, the stress that we have. And when I get these people who have total acceptance, they just engage in their exercises like robots. They just do it, you know? Whereas the rest of us are like spinning. Our heads are spinning, right? Yeah. And that's why they have these amazing, weird miracle cure recoveries. So acceptance, not only will it change your life, and that alone is enough. Forget recovery. If you can improve the quality of your life on an everyday basis and not feel so much distress, I mean, that's our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is not to be well. Our ultimate goal is to be happy. And if you can be happy before you get well, well, yeah, all the better, right? So by having acceptance, you really can reduce the distress in your life. And it's such an important thing. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, and that it reminds me of a couple of people that I've interviewed on my channel who had what seemed like miraculous recoveries. They had severe ME/CFS, bedbound for years, you know, the kind of scary illness where it kind of looks like you just think, like, how is anyone ever going to come back from this? And they had really rapid recoveries that they accredit mostly to brain training programs, but they did share some other things that they did in conjunction with it. But, you know, they've shared that they really felt that their years leading up to that really primed them for that point, because they'd done meditation, they did all these other things. Like, their brains were just ready. Like, they were just so ready to get on board with this program 100% and make all of the changes. And had they tried this at a different point in their journey, it might not have been as successful. So that's an interesting thing about things that help with this illness, is that, you know, what didn't work for you 2 years ago might help you now. Like, it's, I can see how it's confusing for people, but
yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, in a program, I was in my coaching, I talked to people about doing certain treatments. Like, oh, I've tried that before. And go, yes, but that was before you started doing all the other things you're doing now. Mm-hmm. Because once, and this is how often I get contacted by doctors, right? In fact, there's some clinics who focus on CFS and functional medicine and all this that are very well known. And they have all their regimens, and it's very detailed, good medical practice. And, of course, you have a variance. Some patients respond really well. Some patients don't respond really well. And then they get some patients who suddenly go, they're responding really well. And they go, well, why is that? And then they contact me because they find out they're in a program, right? And this isn't meant to be like a plug. What it is meant to represent is to say, once you're doing multiple things at the same time, even the things that you've tried before that didn't work can suddenly work.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, what you're saying is so true. We need to do that. And I think the other thing is, you know, I talk about pure CFS or pure fibromyalgia, where it becomes more of a pure neurological dysfunction, because we're saying it's a neurological illness. But because the illness is complex, it has all these secondary dysfunctions or complications that can trigger it. So, for instance, some people might have another illness, like they might have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or they might have diabetes, type 1 diabetes, or they might have all kinds of things. But often the people who have these fast miracle cures, they've resolved a lot of their physical dysfunction. Like, if they had parasites and candida overgrowth, they've kind of fixed those. They didn't get well from it, but they felt maybe somewhat better. They've fixed all those things, and they've also resolved if they had any psychological complications. So if people had something like PTSD or chronic anxiety, they've resolved these things, and then they're able to have these fast recoveries. So it's a little bit like you hear people, you know, have overnight success in Hollywood. I remember this interview with Morgan Freeman, of all people, who I believe actually experiences fibromyalgia. But people are saying, oh, you had this, wow, overnight you became successful, you know?
Yeah.
And he goes, overnight? He goes, well, what are you talking about? I've been like acting in this business for 20 or 30 years. I can't remember what he said, right? And then you think it's overnight success, right?
Yeah.
And it's like that with these super fast recovery stories. People have been doing stuff, lining up all their ducks in a row, and then bang. But it didn't necessarily happen overnight.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. One other theme I'm thinking of too that I've heard from people who have recovered is that, again, that piece about stress and people that are just, you know, thought it was all kind of baloney and just, you know, I thought meditation was just, you know, not just really not helpful and a waste of time and just people you'd never expect to start embracing this stuff. But they said, you know, I really started working on my mental health. I started meditating. I started doing yoga. I started, you know, I learned strategies to manage my stress and those, you know, micro moments throughout the day. So if there's one other big theme of people who recover things that helped them, I would say that's definitely one. And it was one for me as well.
Absolutely. And again, in the context of understanding it's a maladaptive stress response, it makes sense that handling a stress will help. You know, people always go, oh, what, you're saying I'm just stressed out? I go, exactly. That is exactly what I'm saying. It's just we think of stressed out as being something psychological. And we're also stressed out from our body. And this has nothing to do with our mind at all. If your body is under stress because of it's in such a state of dysfunction and dysregulation, your nervous system responds to that. But absolutely, mental or physical strategies, they're both going to impact the nervous system. And what you say is absolutely true. It's such a common theme in recovery. People find a different way of handling their stress. And I think on that note, I think it's worthwhile raising another thing. If you'd asked me about this 10 years ago, right, about can people recover? Can everyone recover? Can't they recover? I might have shared all kinds of opinions with you. And these opinions would have been based in logic. They would have been based in science. They wouldn't have been based in experience. And it's been interesting because over the 10 years, last 10 years, when I look at my experience, it has changed how I would have answered many of these questions. For instance, there would have been many people I would have said they can't recover. I might have said, well, they've been in a state of dysfunction so long, you know, that their brain is so hardwired that it's pretty hard to change. Yeah. Or I might have said they have such bad physical complications due to other illnesses that they can't recover. Or they have such bad complications due to mental illness that it's impossible for them to recover. And it really makes sense. I mean, and I can really detail to you why that isn't possible, right? And I think there's a pretty good scientific grounding for saying why you can't do it. However, what I have found, and I'm so inspired, sometimes I get teary speaking to people. I go, like they're just so amazing in what they do because they overcome things that you just go, no one can overcome that. You're talking about managing your stress. If you are in a situation where you're being daily abused, or you're suffering from PTSD or schizophrenia, or I mean, how are you supposed to reduce your stress? I mean, do you see? It seems like a ridiculous notion, right? And yet people lift themselves out of the most impossible places and they transcend their problems. They find a way to transcend their problems in a ruthless way. They say, I will find a way, even though it's not possible. And this is a big theme. And I think we can all tap into that power. And one of the ways I help people tap into this power, Raylan, is they present me a problem. And it's literally a problem where you can't fix it. You look at it, you know, that catch-22. They're in this life situation where you say, oh my goodness, that's terrible. I understand completely why you're stressed out. There's literally, I don't think anyone can think of a way out of this, right? Because no matter what you do, it's just a situation, maybe with another person that's ill or something else in the family, right? And then I say to them, if your child was in this situation, I guess they would be stuffed, right? I mean, you can't get out of this. So if your child was in this very same situation you're in, they would just be, that's it. Their life has no purpose and meaning, just they're never going to go anywhere. And you see people get this, oh, and suddenly we think of it differently. Suddenly the impossible in that moment becomes possible. I spoke to someone who had like a problem in the family where they had to stay up at night to look after a family member, because this, if they didn't hear this family member could die, and this family member wasn't an old person. Okay? They were a young person who was meant to live, but they needed to stay awake to make sure that they keep them alive. And so they couldn't get any sleep. And you know how important sleep is with recovering from seizures and fibro. So there's nobody else who can do it in the family. So therefore, you're stuffed. But when I said, imagine this was your child because you had narcolepsy, right? And your child had to stay awake to save this person. What would you say now? Well, you know, I guess they're going to fail at school. They're going to get anxiety, depression. Their life's really going to be completely damaged because they have to look after that person. And suddenly it was like, no, I would find a solution. Suddenly we think outside the scope. I'll get a nurse. I can't afford a nurse. I'll sell the house and the car to get a nurse to look after this other person so that my kid can get to sleep.
Yeah.
So now we become almost brutal in our way, and we change all the rules in our mind to say, I'm going to find a solution because I have to. There's no way I'm going to let my kid go through that. That's what we need to do for ourselves. And sometimes you hear people in recovery stories do that. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, a conversation about how some people get stuck or lack of progress, and it's just they've deprioritized themselves for whatever reason. And, you know, I know for me it was that because I had partially recovered and I was kind of getting by okay. So I think various things, whether it be, you know, they can't justify spending the money anymore, or the guilt kicks in and they feel like they need to start contributing more to their family, or they've partially recovered, so they think, okay, I have to go back to work. But I think that, yeah, not having that priority, and like you said, if it was your child, you would keep that priority there. You'd be like, we're not there yet. And these people that are partially recovered, you know, they're still living incredibly difficult lives. This is no way to be living. So yeah, I think that's all very important. And I think it does contribute, at least in my experience and the people that I talk to, for how some people just kind of get stuck for a while. It's just they take that focus off of themselves.
I think it's a really important thing I've learned from listening, interviewing people who've recovered is this requirement to find, it's not just to do the things like the physical treatments, the diet, the mind-body approaches, meditation. You know, most people have all these kind of things. You'll hear these themes in all the recovery interviews, but it's also, and taking the responsibility, you know, and not, but at the same point, here's that word, responsibility. You know, responsibility can so easily be partnered with self-blame. Because if I'm responsible and I don't recover, then it's my fault, right? And this is unfortunately the outcomes that some people experience from some mind-body programs, you know, which I think is terribly distressing to see. So responsibility and blame, they can come hand in hand, but they mustn't, right? And the way we overcome that is through self-love. And when people really demonstrate that self-love, they create a healing environment, they're forgiving, they're flexible. We're so flexible when we show love, aren't we? Oh, you really messed up. Oh, that was a bit nasty, but I love you, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Right? And I think self-love is a really big theme. Yeah. Do you think there's any others like that?
Just the last one I'm thinking of is that very much listening to your gut and trusting your intuition on things, because we hear things and some things, I mean, I think we have to be open-minded and be willing to try, you know, if we see things that are working for other people, it's good to seriously consider them. But, you know, sometimes we hear something and it just fits. And that one thing might not be the whole solution, but it's enough to put us in that zone where we are pumped up and if something about it fits with our own experience. So, you know, the people I talk to who have recovered have very much listened to their gut and all said similar things like, I heard about this thing and I just knew. I knew this was for me. I knew it was going to help. And maybe that one thing wasn't the whole piece, but it was enough to help them out, to help them to start recover and to give them, you know, that space that they need to be in to do all the other things that they need to get there. Because I hear a lot of things credited, you know, for people's recovery. There is a crazy, just in the, you know, the few people that I've talked to, it's every time I think I've heard it all, I hear something, you know, something new.
Absolutely.
So I think that's really important.
And, you know, it's interesting because I'm not sure I would have brought that point up right now, okay? This particular point wasn't, like, on the top of my mind. And I don't think that's a coincidence because I always say to people there's nothing more powerful than a woman's instinct, right? So isn't it interesting that you bring that up instead of me or I wouldn't have brought it up, to be honest, even though I know this to be true. Right, it's not front of my mind, but this is so true. Listen to your gut instinct. Yeah, in fact, that's why I share all the different recovery stories and even programs that maybe are parallel to my program, because I want people to go, oh, I like that, or I like him, or mm-hmm. like her, and go with their gut instinct, because that means you're going to have more traction, you're going to feel good, you're going to persist better. So yeah, gut instinct is everything. And on that note, mm-hmm. for all the blokes out there, listen to your wife. Listen to your wife's gut instinct. And the same goes for women as well. Listen to your partners, because your partners often understand you better than you do yourself. Whilst they don't understand what you're going through, they do understand you and they see where you can perhaps help yourself better. So it's really important to listen to them.
Yeah, and I think the power in that can be, at least part of it, is that they can be a somewhat more of a neutral third-party observer, because this is one of the things that really helped me, and one of the things now when I talk to people that I encourage them to do is to, because you got to get out of that, you got to take the emotion out of it, because it's a puzzle to be solved, you know, what is happening with your health, and when there's the blame and, you know, the guilt and the frustration and all those other things, it can be really hard to see. So I say, you know, think of yourself as an anthropologist or a detective. Like, you need that third-party neutral perspective, so you can just look at things without judgment and just kind of try and figure it out, try and solve it. So I think that's the value. If you're fortunate to have, you know, a good partner in your life, that you can have those conversations and they might be able to see some things that you're not seeing because you're just too deep in it, or they can ask the questions or help you have that different insight into things.
Absolutely. But one of the other things I've seen in my recovery interviews is that it's all about striking a balance. So it's about having that, but not getting, like we said earlier, about people who get bogged down, who get lost in the details, go down in rabbit holes. You've got to have that balanced approach. Yeah, I'm doing this, but I'm resilient, I'm focused, I'm going to keep going. But it's like, you know, you can't love it too much. You can't struggle too hard. You know, you squeeze the life out of your recovery process.
Yeah.
You've got to be a little bit, just go with it, you know. And I think that's important. There's a lot of anxiety, you know. Most of us tend to experience health anxiety because we're ill, right?
Yeah.
And with some people, that anxiety really gets out of hand, and I think it can really stop them. I mean, have you come across that a lot?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's got to be balanced for sure. If you're permanently stuck in that zone of just analyzing every single thing, you're going to make yourself crazy and probably cause yourself a lot of stress. I think it's good to have some checkpoints and check in, you know, once a month, how things are going. Let's take a look at my progress of my health, what seems to be working, what do I need to tweak. But yeah, getting too bogged down in that, I don't think is going to get you anywhere.
Look, as we sort of start to move towards finishing up our podcast today, Raylan, I guess I wonder, is there something that's really concerned you the most in listening to recovery stories, or something particularly successful or anything else that you feel you would like to share about your experience?
Well, there's two things really, and we've touched on both of them already a bit, but one of them is that when people first get the diagnosis of, you know, things like ME/CFS, you know, some of these chronic conditions that are still poorly understood in the medical community, is that people seem, I don't know if you found this, but quite often have this brief moment of relief and excitement, like, yes, I have a name, I have a label, I have something, we have a starting point. But then before they even leave the doctor's office, it's like it's already crashed. All hope is gone because they're told that there's no treatment, that almost no one recovers. And then they get home, of course, and they start Googling on the internet, as we all do. And what they find, what people tell me, is that it is really hopeless and depressing. So it's really concerning for me that even now, where we are, with how many people that are recovering, the main message out there is still to people who first get this, that there's basically no hope, because that just seems really dangerous. I don't know if you're still hearing this from the people that you talk to, or if it's turning around a bit.
Look, I think people get mixed messages. I mean, you're right. This is absolutely the experience. It's relief, distress.
Yeah.
And like, I'm not sure there's much of a gap in between.
Yeah, right? It's really fast.
It's like, I mean, was this positive or was it negative? You know,
yeah.
It seems to end negatively. So sometimes I feel like poor doctors are given a bit of a hard time sometimes, because it's like it seems you can do no right. Because, yes, I do still hear many doctors tell their patients, oh, there's nothing I can do, you're going to have this forever, you might have some good years, but then you'll have bad years. It's just nothing. You know, this is a permanent disease, is the word, right? And this is very damaging. If you understand what a maladaptive stress response is, to hear something like that,
yeah,
it's not going to be good for your well-being. And in the same, some doctors will say something quite positive. Well, look, you just had this virus and blah, 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 and you know, it might take 6 months and you'll probably be better. Sometimes it could take a couple of years and you should get to good health again.
Yeah.
And that's then often not our experience. And then people get really angry because they said, the doctor said this, and that's not what happens. And the internet's full of people who stay sick forever.
Mm-hmm.
We've already qualified that earlier, so we don't need to go into that again. But
yeah,
you know, from my point of view, you know, people say, oh, how long will it take to recover in my program? And obviously the program is not a guaranteed recovery, is it? Right? Mm-hmm. It's not a magic cure. But I'm like, should I aim for 3 months, like those miracle cure people? Should it be like 12 months, like I see some of the other people in the program, which is more common? Or should it be 2 years or 4 years or, you know, 1 week? And I'm like, you know what? I think it's better to aim for something shorter term and be a little bit disappointed than to aim for too long, because chances are you're shooting yourself in the foot. You know, and the key here, and this is probably one of the key messages about all of this, you know, I said earlier about not having such a anxious attitude towards your recovery, a little bit lighthearted about it. Even with your goals, right? People don't want to make goals, because goals always get dashed when you're ill, chronically ill, and then you feel terrible, right? And I'm like, well, it's okay to make a goal for 3 months. Make the goal to be recovered, or as unrealistic as that may be, it's realistic for some.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be one of those. And or make the goal to be doing really well with your recovery in 3 months, right? Or to have made progress. And then if you find you fall short of that, but you've made some improvement, great. Well, then just change it. Don't be devastated. Oh, I didn't reach my goal. I'm devastated. You know, these kind of behaviors, that's what they are. They're behaviors, they're choices, right? These kind of behaviors of, I'm going to do this, and if I don't, then I'm going to be absolutely devastated, my life will end, or I have to recover now. I have to recover because I can't live with this illness anymore, or I have to become XYZ, a Hollywood star, a famous actress, a dancer, or whatever. Yeah. I have to create so much stress. It's not the way, and this is why acceptance is so important. Yeah, we accept that we're ill. We accept it's a process. Okay, I'm still ill, but I'm doing better. Just, you need a softer attitude. And yet, supported by a quiet fortitude, a quiet resilience, a quiet, I'm not going to settle for less, but I'm okay with the fact that it hasn't happened right now.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. Our expectations, whether optimistic or pessimistic, can be really powerful, which is why it's concerning to me when I talk to so many people that get these messages straight out the gate. Because I think if you internalize that, that can be a really powerful limiting belief and can really impact your success with your recovery. So it's just not a really great place to start. And when I think about the other thing that I hear that's quite concerning, was just that piece around depression and how many people, you know, I don't know a percentage, but it's a really high number. The vast majority of the people that I have interviewed have told me that they have felt suicidal at some point during their journey. Some people have told me that they have attempted suicide during their journey. And some of these people have felt this way when their symptoms weren't at their worst. You know, we think it's when people are bedbound, and for sure, sometimes people can be in that space. But I think at every stage or every level of severity of this illness, we need to take that mental health component very seriously, because it is very heartbreaking and devastating how many people we're losing to this illness just because that depression isn't treated. So I know I talked about this already, but I think it's just a really important thing to drive home, because a lot of people seem to be going through bouts of this in their journey. So we just really need that mental health support there for people so that they're not getting to those really, you know, hopeless places.
Yeah, look, absolutely. We lose people this way.
Mm-hmm.
We lose people, and like I say, it's not usually at the lowest, because they wait until they can get well enough to do it.
Yeah.
And it is a devastating loss. And, you know, this is all based on our beliefs. I mean, I couldn't really entertain thoughts like that, right? I had responsibilities. I had a family. If we're not in that position, it becomes easier to entertain these thoughts. And you might even say logical. If you say, I can't, this is unbearable suffering, and there is no hope, and I've tried everything. It's not an illogical conclusion that this might make sense. But it's based on false assumptions. It's based on the assumption that whilst I'm ill, I can't have quality of life. That's the first false assumption. And I mean, that's the assumption. That's my experience, right? But I can tell you that there are people who don't live like that, right? And learning how to have some quality of life, even though we feel ill, is a really key step forward. Not just in terms of your quality of life and your mental health, but actually for your physical recovery too. So that's the first mistake I think people make. The second mistake is, of course, this idea that recovery is impossible. And if they know that other people recover, then they say, well, recovery isn't possible for me. And I honestly, heart in hand, would not say that to anyone. I don't believe that. And I'm not saying it to them just to boost them or to make them feel better. I no longer believe that it's not possible. And even if people don't end up making a full recovery, there is so much. You get to 80% functioning, can have a great quality of life just with that. And I always say, you know, I've always focused on full recovery, because I've seen people get near full and then go back again, right? So I say, don't stop when you're just before your goal. Keep going and get full recovered and become robust in your recovery, and understand why you got ill and understand how you got well, because some people don't really understand that. And those are keys to ensure you stay recovered and that you're robust. But let's recognize that even without any recovery, we can find joy. And if we have thoughts, anyone who's listening, if you ever have thoughts like this of self-harm, you need to seek help. You need to stop anything bad from happening, because you are in a state of delusion. We all live in a state of delusion. We think that life is as we perceive it in the moment. It is not. And the old anecdote of, well, tomorrow is another day. You know, tomorrow is another day. And you can wake up another day and suddenly see new possibilities. I mean, you hear that in the recovery interviews all the time, don't you, Raylan?
Yeah.
Where people have that moment, they wake up one day and they go, oh, now I had this breakthrough and suddenly everything changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think people listening need to recognize that there is a change. And if you doubt that in this moment, if you doubt that right now listening, then recognize this. Have you felt like the way you do at your worst before? And has there been anything in between? Chances are that you felt really hopeless before and then things didn't seem so bad one day. So if it's happened in the past, it can definitely happen again.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think a lot of what is happening, you know, I can think about and speak about my own journey because I had a couple, you know, points in my journey where my depression got severe and I just felt really hopeless. And I think that's it. I don't think anybody wants to stop living. They're just tired of the pain and the struggle and they want it to stop. And they've lost hope in that moment that it's ever going to stop or that things are ever going to get better. So I think that's really important what you said. And I generally try and keep things optimistic and perky, but if we gloss over the really dark parts of this illness, I think we're doing people a disservice because the more I talk about this, the more people reach out to me and, you know, say, thank you for helping bring this out into the light. And when people tell me that when they are in those really dark moments, that watching the recovery interviews that people like you and I put out are one of the things that help them get through it. It's just getting that perspective again, that hope just to get you through that moment. And exactly like you said, you may have felt like this before and it did pass. So it's really important to reach out to people when you're in that kind of a space.
It's false evidence. In that moment where you feel it's really like that and you're so convinced that nothing can get better and this is how your life's going to be and there's no way to cope and suffer with it any longer, it's based on false evidence. It's not really looking at all the facts, you know, and I can't state that strongly enough that we need to judge it on another day.
Yes.
Well and on said. That note, closing messages are, what are the main takeaways? Look, the main takeaways for me, first of all, is recovery is possible. Mm. And it's possible to overcome all odds, right? It is possible to overcome the odds even when you think there's no such thing. Before I share another one, I guess, what about you? What's another one for you that really a closing takeaway?
That is my biggest one. That is absolutely what I would have said, that even in the most dire of circumstances, people do get past it. And I know in those moments, it can feel like you're never going to, or it just like, I am too sick. I am too far gone. This is never going to improve. But it is amazing, amazing what people come back from. So to me, that's by far my biggest takeaway. And I think, you know, like, I think we've been driving home this whole conversation, just the power of your mindset and your perspective and your stress management and your mental health and all of that is so important. So, and I think a big piece of that is that you need to be almost ruthless with what and who you surround yourself with in terms of the information that you're taking in. You know, is it depressing? Is it negative? Or is it optimistic and recovery focused? Who are the people you're surrounding yourself with? And you know, what kind of energy are they putting out? So if anyone is making you feel drained or more hopeless as a result of your interaction with them or information sources as your result of your interacting with them, I think it's really important to have strict boundaries. Mm. And that's something that I hear from a lot of people who recover. Like, I just had to get, you know, really focused and block out all that other stuff and just keep my head where I needed it to be.
Absolutely. I hear it. I left the support groups. I yep. left those friends. I left the spouses, right? People take big steps you're absolutely right. And look, the last thing I would probably like to say that I learned from doing all these recovery interviews and having spoken to hundreds of people who've recovered now is that it's not what you do, it's how you do it. Just want to pause on that for a moment, listen to what I'm saying. It's not just what you're doing, it is how you do it. I see sometimes people do exactly the same stuff for the same problems, but the difference is how they approach what they're doing. And to me, I think that is probably the number one takeaway and distinction to allow you to propel your recovery to the next level. And on that note, Raylan, I thank you so much for sharing. It's awesome to have not just a kindred spirit in terms of someone who recovered, but a kindred spirit in terms of someone who speaks to other people who have recovered.
Different people. Yeah, this is great.
So it's lovely to have you on this podcast, and perhaps you'll have us join us again on another podcast in the future.
Yeah, that would be great. I thank you so much for having me here. I very much enjoyed this discussion. I have so much respect for the work that you do, and I think it's really great to get as much information out on this, as we can. And if people want to get in touch with me, they are free to do so. They can find me on, my website is raylanagle.com, or on Instagram, raylan.agle, or my YouTube channel, which is just my name as well, Raylan Agle. So yeah,
absolutely.
Reach out, say hello. I'd love to hear from you.
We'll share those links for you in the show notes. So visit the website, cfsunravel.com. And check out the podcast, and you'll find the podcast and the show notes where you see all the links. All right. Until next time, everyone, I hope you enjoyed getting some wisdom from the other side.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the podcast. We hope you felt supported by it. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us via cfsunravel.com. And make sure that you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to it. And you can leave a comment and a 4 or 5 star review if you feel so inclined. If you want to make sure you get your free copy of Discover Hope and get notified about all new recovery resources and interviews, including recovery interviews, subscribe to us via the website. Check out some of our other podcasts. I hope you'll join us again soon.